Well, good morning. My name is Tom Berger. This is the Alaska Native Review Commission. We have been going around to every region of Alaska holding meetings to give Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally an opportunity to discuss the way in which the Alaska Native Claims Settlement of 1971 has worked out. We've been to villages on the west coast, Amonik and Tununik. We've been to Gulkana and Copper Center in the Atna region. We have been to Tanagross and Nenana in the interior. These Alaska Native students at the University of Alaska at Fairbanks asked us to come there and hold a meeting, and we did, and about 35 of the students there made presentations to the commission. We held 3 days of meetings in downtown Fairbanks for the Alaska Native people living in that area, and altogether about 75 of them made presentations to the hearings. People are concerned about the Claims Settlement Act. They're concerned about the 1991 issues, transferability of shares, taxation of land, the question whether the children born since 1971 should participate in the settlement, and they're concerned as well about the question of Native self-government. So we've been hearing about all of these questions. We began our meetings in Juneau last night, and we had a very good meeting that went on till almost 11 o'clock, and we decided we'd come down and hold meetings today, this morning, this afternoon, and again this evening, and then again tomorrow, so that people at their convenience could come in and present their views. Everything that is said is being recorded by Jeff Berliner on this machinery here, and is then being typed up, and permanent record of the transcript of the proceedings is going to the University of Alaska at Fairbanks. We will, in any event, be sending transcripts of what is said here to the ANB and the Tlingit and Haida Central Council and Sea Alaska. And when we have finished these meetings, which will last, I think, very likely the remainder of the year, I'll write a report that will be made public next year and will be sent to everybody who spoke at these meetings. So with that introduction, I just want again to welcome you here and to say that when you speak, if you wouldn't mind coming up and sitting in this chair so that your views can be recorded. Apart from that, we'll try to proceed in the most informal way. I think some of you know Eileen McLean, seated over here, who works with the commission, and Jeff Berliner, who is taking everything down, and my wife is here too. She's the lady in the red hair, with the red hair, I should say, seated behind John Borbridge, she's her only excuse for being here is that she likes traveling with me. So, whoever would like to begin, we have a sign-up list, but we found that usually people just decide in their own time and in their own way when they'd like to participate. So we're open for business. Yes, please. Okay. Not only that chair, but this microphone.
Do I have to identify myself?
Well,
I'm very bad at that.
Well, if you don't do it, we'll get somebody else to identify you.
That's fine, as long as it's, my wife is not the redhead. She is the blonde behind Joan Corbin. I think that every woman in the room should sit behind John. That's a good place to be.
Well, he's collecting them there already.
Yes. Justice Berger, my name is Roger Lang. I've been involved in the Alaska Native movement for 17 years, here and in Southeast and on a statewide basis. And I know that part of your thing is to measure expectations of the act of individual natives, no matter where you go. I think that's a good move, because while many people see 1991 as a problem, I see it as an opportunity, a window of opportunity to do further good for Alaska Natives. I don't know what they might be yet. I don't think anyone does. But so far, when we considered the common good of Alaska Natives, either in Washington or in Juneau, we have not lost a war. We might have lost a few battles, but not a war. And in our movement, we have developed, beyond leadership, statesmen, Evan Hobson, John Borbidge, Emil Nardi, who could, again, perform for the common good of Alaska Natives in 1991. It's been an amazing process to sit and observe the change of how we are perceived. The Claims Act, as you know, is composed of four components. There is organization, the village and regional corporation. There is land. And finally, there is money. Unfortunately, the money came before any of the rest of it. And that was the first and the toughest judgment made on us as people, how we handle money, not our stewardship with the land or ownership of it. But you can read newspaper files for the last 15 years and you'll see Native Corporation failed, or Native Corporation loses money. And you'll not, in the same period, find one article about any other corporation in the state doing the same thing. About 7 months ago, I suffered a stroke. It's a very debasing and debilitating disease. It removed my ability to speak and walk. And I'm just getting that back now. What I can't do is hide emotion. But I think, as a people, the Alaska Natives have come much further since December 1871 than any segment of society anywhere in the world. And they did it themselves. I think the Claims Act is simply a tool, not the end, but a tool given to us. So that villages, so that regions, so that collectively Alaska Natives can do what's necessary to survive. And survival ought to be what we see it and not what Congress or newspapers or anyone else thinks it is. We have completely rewritten the educational system in Alaska because of ANSCA. We've become a fairly significant political force, and frankly, we own a bank. We do several things not even dreamt of 10 to 15 years ago. We're also finding out that you can be a Native banker and a Native lawyer and a Native teacher. You don't have to give up the Native part to make it anymore in our world. I think our expectations in certain areas of economics will never be met, because we live in a country called America and a state called Alaska who have not devised any method for equal distribution of wealth. And I don't think that should be something that's given to us either for solution. Unless I let other parts of our life alone too. I don't know what eventually we will be, but eventually, the basis for every great movement in America has been the ownership of land. And we have that. It's not been used as a tool yet. And it's not realized its full economic potential because of world conditions on timber and oil and fish. But those situations will change, and hopefully we can reap better economic benefits just by being what we are and where we are and what lands we own. It's strange to be an Alaska Native in 1984. To worry about the strength of the American dollar because it affects you. I always thought a strong dollar meant that we were doing well. It doesn't mean that at all. It means that a strong dollar diminishes the ability of foreign nations to buy our product, fish and timber. So, but I am heartened by the fact that the people of Sitka and Angoon and Craig and Kulak now are important enough to consider world markets, world money trading, and to worry about the Federal Reserve Board setting interest rates. I don't know what the world thinks we are, but I know what we could be. And basically, the Alaskan Native have not made a serious mistake or a dishonest act since the Claims Act passed. I think every intention has been right. Our investments might not have been the best, but nothing in the Act said that we had to become the best investor of money in the world. And given the record of what we are and what we could be, I think we do very well. Hopefully, we will devise a means to use with a rational basis the younger people who are better educated, stronger motivated than I was when I moved. I think the problems of the afterborn, the problems of the elders are very great. And while corporations might not be the best way to answer those problems, they are one of the best ways to own land that I know of. Especially fee simple land. While I don't have a great fear of the taxation of lands after 1991, I do have some fears historically on what happens to American Indians when that occurs. It would pay us as Natives to look very carefully at the Menominee and what happened to them, and to learn from that. I think 1991 is a window of opportunity, and that our effort should not be to survive 91, but to become beyond that what we have to. Other factors, the 1985 study you probably heard about, might help us in that light. It'll certainly make Congress again aware that there are Alaska Natives and that they have special problems. Unfortunately, there's not a discovery in Prudhoe Bay to egg things on. Watts isn't burning, Detroit isn't burning, and D.C. isn't burning. I'm not sure what kind of climate we'll have in 1991, but it's one in which we must be ready to talk rationally about our problems to the Congress. I think several of our problems, especially the afterborn problem, can be handled in-house without changing laws. All we have to do is get our shareholders to agree. I think we need beyond 1991 to be able to prove that our children are Alaska Native. And we ought to do it without enrolling by a set of regulations established by a Bureau of Indian Affairs. We should do it ourselves. We should be able to certify who we are and what that entitles us to. We should tell the government we have reached a degree of sophistication where we do not require the BIA in one corner and the public health in another to sit and determine what they'll do for us under which set of regulations. That everybody that has served Alaska Natives in Alaska ought to get their butts together and decide how they can do it collectively to better our life. We are not what we were 10 years ago or 20 years ago. Our needs are not those. They've changed significantly, and they'll change in another 10 years. We have not sat down with the state of Alaska and said, develop policies that fit rural Alaska Native. Devise economics that are, quote, village economics. You cannot go to a university and learn village economics 101. It's there, it works. It has produced, as poor as village economics are, it has produced Native millionaires, or very near. And will do so in the future. We need to convince the state that it is in their economic interest to promote the diversity of languages and cultures. That's what makes this state interesting. It's not the fact that we own oil and trees and timber. It's the fact that we have different kinds of people. The reason I came up first was because you are in Southeast, where the most eloquent speakers are in Alaska, maybe even America. And I thought I better shoot before the good ones get on. I'll be very honest with you, though. As a politician and an Alaska Native, I did not agree with the formation of this commission at its initiation. I didn't think that a neutral group could be found which would hear our problems in that light. I read some of your Canadian papers, your papers. I agree basically with your philosophy. I find the Canadian method of handling Canadian Indians quite strange. I don't think I'll ever understand status and non-status. But the basis for much of what we do is English law. Our people in this area spent 32 years in the courts proving Indian title to land. And some new entities have risen since the Claims Act. There's a reinstitution of what we call IRA counts, rechartering of those. The IRAs in Southeast are very old. in other areas of the state, they might be brand new. But in our area, they've been around for years. At one time, they owned almost every cannery in Southeast, every fleet of boat. And they are not a strange entity to us. We're deeply versed in the history of Alaska and IRAs, where we might be short, it's in what teaching what an IRA is, its function and its purpose, and why it was founded. The result has been that there are diverse views throughout the state of what an IRA is and its ability to either govern or to own whatever, lands or resources. I don't think anyone has fully explored that. I fear somewhat that we'll not force those issues. As a collective Native movement, we have never taken the matter of Indians and their special relationship to the federal government off of the back burner. We have left that as a problem that we will someday address. We are fast approaching a time where we need to address that problem. The Congress does not terminate its relationship with American Indians and Alaska Natives by accident. It doesn't do it by regulation of bureaucracies. It does it specifically. It said, Menominee, we sever our crust relationship with you, or we give it back to you. The Secretary of Interior, in my eyes, is not empowered with that, nor is the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So it's my feeling that the Claims Act has not severed, not even entered, or begin the entry. Some people see it as a termination tool. Well, the termination tools of Congress are very specific. And I've read that act from word one to word last. I don't find it anywhere in there. I hold my relationship with the United States government quite dear. And I think that it is what it was prior to the act, and it will be that until, as a people, we decide that it's no longer necessary for us to espouse. It has been invaded in some very technical and legal basis. The Beaufort Sea court case carried with it a mention of Alaska Native subsistence rights. And little by little, people have chewed at sovereignty or the ability of Alaska Natives to rule. And sovereignty is a very difficult issue for me, because it's strange to say, but the ownership of Alaska Native lands, this is a brand new word to me, was almost done on a condominium basis as opposed to a, here's a line around my lands, and if you step over the line, I'll either kill you or have a war we did not do what the Western nations of Europe. We did not define ownership or sovereignty that tight. But that's not to say that nobody knew what was going on. Every creek, every bay, every mountain, every rock had a use. And people know what that was and who used it and who it belonged to. The tribal system in this area is 10,000 years old. It owned lands. It governed people. It had no jails. It had no orphans. And it was a good system. But it gets lost occasionally. Because as we become a culture to a political and economic basis called Alaska, you have to give up certain parts so that you can become a part of a mega world, sometimes called America, sometimes called Alaska, and now called the Pacific Rim. We have stretched to Korea, Japan, the Philippines, Taiwan in our consideration. Your circumpolar to Savunga. So, and we've survived. I would imagine that we would survive anything devised by anyone, so long as we kept a bigger aim as our goal. I don't want to be a millionaire. I want my child and his children to have a say in what they are. And more importantly, who they are. I thank you for allowing me to speak.
Thank you very much, sir. Thank you. I do appreciate it.
My name is Gene Strong from Clukwan, and I spoke last night, and I wanted to finish some of my things I had to say, but we ran out of time, and so I'll continue today just a little bit because I have to catch my plane home. But I thank you for this opportunity to allow us to convey our feelings and messages to this commission, and it feels like it's our last plea before we have to really assert ourselves. This commission, I feel like it's going to do something because it's coming from the grassroots people. You're hearing it from the people that live in the villages and not the high execs or, you know, above the grassroots people. The feeling I have because of this commission, I hope that the U.S. government would take this commission's report and really consider it really heavily, because when the 1991 comes around, it's when we're going to act. We're preparing ourselves now to the things that we feel is really necessary, and our traditional things that we so long do express and enjoy sharing with other people, that 1991 is going to probably trigger some kind of chain reaction, that the federal government's going to have to stop and listen to us. I wanted to reemphasize the things that was said last night and the things I said and things that Mr. Lang has also said. But also I'd like to say that should it come to pass that the U.S. government recognizes us as our way of life, that we have the best of two worlds, that some of the people and politicians don't realize we have the best of two worlds today, in that we have federal funds coming to the state. And if some of the state politicians, not to knock them, because we still want to work with the state people, the organizations that are here, the government, we want to be part of their, you know, sharing their feelings, but we also want them to recognize our feelings. But we do bring federal dollars into the state coffers, and if they want to assimilate the native people into their type of government, then they're going to lose this outside funds that we get from the federal government. Plus, they're going to lose the real meaning that they're starting to develop on, is in the tourism industry. The tourists like to come to Alaska because the native people and their unique ways of life that they never experienced in the past, like the reservations down south. See, these people in Alaska still have the ability to roam outside the reservations. We don't have reservations here. We can move in our tribal organizations. We know who we are. We can go over to the other tribes and visit with them. So we are a living aspect of the world that was before Columbus Day. The tourists like to come up here in the States capitalizing on it, but they don't share the funds that is generated by this to the all the people and the native people. Some of the inequities there. I remember the state government used to be able to fund native organizations, you know, by us lobbying our representatives and senators. But each administration, due to politics from outside of Alaska, has made it come today where everything has to be funded to a first-class city or recognized borough of some kind that is constructed by the state or the federal government. So now the native people, like for our village council in Skagway, which I'm representing or helped put together up there, we have to go through the Skagway City Council, and it's like begging for money from them to put it on their priority list. And we always help all the people in the the cities and villages that we live in. The Native people never cited who we're going to serve and who we're not going to serve. We treated our non-Native people as brothers and sisters as well as we treated each other. But now, just because we have this Native stigma thing, or Indian, it's kind of a political stigma that they always say we're getting things that, you know, special treatment, which I don't believe we are getting special treatment, but this is what they're saying. And it's caused state politicians to turn away from us because of this. And it made it hard for us to get funds from the state. We used to be able to get funding direct from the legislators, but now we can't. And the state and federal-owned city corporations or city councils or city form of government don't recognize the human side of things, where the Native people always recognize the human needs. Do I see the city or the state form of government? It's infrastructure, things that you drive on, the things that you look at. You know, they want to beautify the city up, and they got state funds that they get from the oil royalties or from logging or something, taxes. That's building sewer and roads, but then they don't take care of the people themselves. So what is a good, beautiful city if there's nobody in there to live because you're not providing for those people? We still like to work with the people that are around with the United States, because that's the democracy that they like to see us in, that we already have. I feel that the Native people already had this kind of democracy where we all work together and we're all equal. They're still learning this, and we have to keep proving to them that we know what we're doing so they can learn from us. But for some reason, they feel that they have to be above us. Right now we have best of two worlds, like I was saying. If only the U.S. could recognize that, then we'd get a lot further in the world. Like was testified earlier this morning, we're always fighting to prove ourselves with the lawyers, proving our lands, proving our way of life. For what? I don't know, I can't understand why if we can accept them, why can't they accept us as who we are? And then we can work more harmoniously with each other instead of devising laws how to govern each other. Pretty soon, this democracy and free world is going to be tied up in CFRs and laws, and it's not going to be a free world. It will be a social state governed by people we don't even know who's governing us, because it gets so complicated and tied up in laws, and it's not going to be a free world anymore. I think the biggest thing I have to say is that we would like to have more control of our own lifestyles, as everybody else in the world is doing or is trying to do or are doing. I don't know why we have to go into their lifestyles. If we can accept theirs, they should be able to accept ours. I want to reemphasize that the people are, we came a long ways, like they always say the women came a long ways. Well, the Native people come a long ways too, to learn the non-Native ways, lifestyles. And we're finding out their lifestyles is what we already had, but for some reason they still don't recognize that. Our education and everything's the same. It's just, it's looked at different. I don't have much more to say other than to say to the commission that the way I feel, this is almost our last plea to ask the federal government and the U.S. To listen to us. These are the people in their boundaries. Listen to us before something happens, before everybody gets tied up in courts. We don't want that. We want to live harmoniously with everybody. And I feel real honored to be able to speak in this commission, and I feel real honored to have a person such as you, the Honorable Justice Berger, to take time to listen and listen to the concerns and relay it to those people that was employed you to bring those testimonies together. I really thank you for giving us another chance to express ourselves and hope the outside world, which is all our world, will listen to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strong.
My name is Roy Clayton from Haines. I represent the Chilkoot Indian Association. They asked me to say a few words about the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act and how it affected us. In 1941, we organized under the Indian Reorganization Act and were recognized by the federal government to be a tribal government. Along came the Settlement Act. It abolished everything. We were not recognized as a tribe. We still exist as an IRA, but we have no village, we have no land. And ever since 1971, our membership has been fighting to obtain some land. We've tried just about everything we know. We have no money, no funding, and we seem to have a problem of we can't interest any lawyers in helping us, our cause. It seems strange to us that we were not recognized as a village. They said that the ratio of non-native to native was too great. We cannot be recognized as a village. Yet along comes Juneau, where the ratio must be much greater. They call them an urban corporation. Why couldn't we be an urban corporation? I've read the law, and I'm not a lawyer. I don't really understand, know how these things happen, but they have surely happened. There was one reservation in a Haines area called Yendestucky. It was basically a Chilkat Native reservation, but a lot of Chilkoot people lived there also. And we used to have a village along the Chilkoot River, just north of Haines. The people, due to wanting to make money and whatever, gradually moved into the town of Haines, abandoned the village, except for berry picking, catching fish, and such as that. Well, in the last couple of years since I've been involved with the Chilkoot Indian Association, we have been working to try to get some of that land back. The Yendestucky Preserve, we have tentative plans what we would like to do with it if we ever get the land. so far have been unable to get any help from anywhere. Even our congressional delegation has turned me down. And also, last year we started what we call our Chilkoot Cultural Camp on an old village site at Chilkoot River. It's a camp for kids, children, to come and learn the traditional Tlingit way of life. The land is not ours according to law, but it is according to us. So we are now camped there, and we hope to have a large camp this summer. The few kids that were there last year really enjoyed it, but yet law seems to be going against us, but we're going to go ahead anyway. That land, we feel the land is ours. We're going to make use of it. The Park Service has set up a state campground right next door. They like us there. That gives the people that are staying in the campground something to do. They come over and look at our operation. You know, they're in our favor, but they can't help us. We've talked to the Bureau of Land Management. They say they can't do anything for us. That's native tribal land. Well, who do you think you're talking to? You know, if we're not natives and we're the people from that land, they still couldn't help us. And Sea Alaska has applied for that part of that land as a historic site, which means if that goes through, then probably there's no way we could ever touch it because it'll have to remain untouched as a historic site, cemetery site. So here we are. What do we do now? That's a question my people keep asking me. What do we do next? I said, I don't know, but I'm sure going to research some more and see if we can come up with something. And now I'd like to switch over to my own personal thoughts on the Settlement Act. I think the whole idea behind the original thought was great, but the way the act is implemented, what has happened since, doesn't seem so great to me anymore. We've created monsters with the regional corporations. Somebody like me, myself personally, I'm called an at-large member of Sea Alaska. What is an at-large member? I really have no voice. I try to speak to somebody, they don't hear me. You know, who are you? I'm an at-large member of your corporation. I have no village corporation to go to. The exorbitant salaries that the people are paying themselves is unreal to me. They talk about Sea Alaska is not making money. Well, if they would cut their salaries in half and live like the rest of us have to live, then they'd probably make a lot of money. And as far as the so-called new natives or the newborn Alaskan, I believe that they should be helped somehow. But how, I have no great idea. Tony Strong mentioned his idea on the situation, and that sounds good to me. The only thing I was thinking about was, say there's two children born and only one older person passes on. What do you do then? Do you give them each 50 shares of stock while everybody else has 100 shares? So maybe that idea is not too great either, but I don't have a better idea. And one other point I wanted to touch on was, on the land. It's been brought up that several village corporations are trying to find ways to give land to their shareholders. I think that's a great idea. I would wholeheartedly be in favor of that. Give everybody 5 acres or 1 acre, depending how much land is available. At least people would have something. I also have thought about if it was possible for the profit corporations to deed the land to the nonprofit like the IRAs and traditional village councils and put it in, so to speak, trust for the people. That way, when 1991 comes around, we won't have to worry about the land disappearing. Our stock might go, or the corporation, such as Sea Alaska, might just disappear, but we would still have the land. The land is very important, I believe, to the native people of Alaska. We need land. We have to have land. It's always been ours, and it should always be ours. With that, I guess I'll close, and thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Claycomb. Thank you very much.
Good morning. My name is John Martin. I appeared last night before last night's hearing, and it was my attitude to submit for the record some documents relating to the executive order which I spoke about last night. The executive order is 7179, and it is under the U.S. survey number 2459. And in reviewing these documents, some of these documents are, there are still some inconsistencies, and I submit these to you for the record.
Thank you.
And for giving it some thought last night, I want to reinforce again that in working with the Bureau and working with my uncle, Charles Jack Sr. Charles Jack Sr., several years ago, took me to the Kadishan allotment, and he showed me the trail that was blazed for his hunting trapping site. And most recently, I found out that the allotment lines had been moved to tidelands instead of the timbered area where my grandfather used to trap. And I recently discovered also, adjacent to the Kadishan allotment, there's a little confusion here, that the Andrew Jack allotment was applied for by Paul Kadishan, which was my mother's first husband. And Paul Kadishan then applied for allotment across the river adjacent to the Andrew Jack allotment. And that was after 1935, or somewhere thereabouts. And that allotment is still pending. So you can understand my concern that of the inconsistency and the irregularities. And we talk about the Township Act of 1926, or yeah, 1926, where people testified and reviewed as to who of ownership of land. I have the highest respect for the people with the Department of Interior and their attitude in dealing with the Native people. However, the question that I have is, if there is irregularities in existence or inconsistencies, how do we rectify those inconsistencies and irregularities without actually reviewing the situation? And my attitude in testifying today is, we talk about 1991, when my children are actually asking about these inconsistencies and irregularities. In the event that they are proven that has never been contested, then they too will have those questions on their minds regarding Tenneke and the executive order. Why was Tenneke not considered for the village status when there is an executive order that was in existence where the U.S. government recognized the fact that Tenneke was, in essence, settled by the native people prior to any non-natives coming into that area. I am the living tradition of my grandfather, and my grandfathers were the first settlers in Tenneke. So those are areas that that I covered last night, and I want to enforce the fact with those documents that I submitted this morning. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Austin Hammond, I'm from Haines. What I want to say about Chilkoot and Roy was talking about, Roy Clayton, I've been started for my grandchildren to have a camp there to teach them how to put up some fish and to teach how to put up some berries long time ago before the jars and the freezer we have. Everything what we used to do, we want them to learn it. And I have a camp there. So my grandchildren could learn more about Chilkoot. And this, what I told them, what I learned from my great-great-grandfather. His name is Joe Whiskers. And I got the family tree, I got them on. The story he told me about Chilkoot, I teach it to my grandchildren. So that's where it came to my mind, all these things here, to tell the stories. A lot of times I hear some of our white brothers, they're saying that, I think it just came not too long ago. Then I mention, I think it what they learned from the flood, the story about Chilkoot. If you come up and see what I'm talking about, the two men have went out halibut hand chicken. There were two of them sitting there, and they didn't know that flood was coming. When they look around, they see it. The trees is going underwater. And the raven, they're telling with it